You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Ivy Pacoda is the author of Wonder Valley, Visitation Street, and These Women. She won the 2018 Strand Critics Award for Best Novel and France's Prix Page America, and has been a finalist for the Edgar Award and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Her new novel is Sing Her Down. Thank you for joining me, Ivy.
You're so welcome. I'm so glad to be back on your show.
Ivy, this is a wonderful book, and as I read it, especially the opening part, and the way you wrote the prose, the way the book is constructed, and again, particularly the prose, I just thought it was very musical. And the first part of the book, which is set mostly in a woman's prison out there in the hellish desert of Arizona, reminded me, you know, of the opening of a rock opera that might be scored by the Sex Pistols and sung by Chrissy Hynde. was music an influence in this book?
Not in particular. It's funny that you say that. I have to write in complete silence, and I don't understand how people have music on when they write, or write in cafes or headphones on. But, you know, the book is sort of inspired by, this is so pretentious, sort of like the oral tradition of like epic poetry, which I also see in like Westerns and like the sort of gather around the campfire. And there's a musicality to that type of writing and that storytelling. It's poetic. And I think the music that you might be picking up on is definitely sort of that choral ode, that sort of, you know, bardic poetic tradition. This is why people are afraid of my books, is because I say stuff like this. I'm like, do you know anything about the, you know, oral tradition of ancient Swedish and Greek poetry passed down by the bards? But it's true. It is sung. It's a sung tradition. And I think that's where a lot of the inspiration of the book came from. So there is the musical element, though it's not the kind of music that, you know, people think about today.
The opening of the novels, as I mentioned earlier, is set in a women's prison. Did you actually visit that particular women's prison? I looked up. It's a real place.
Perryville? Yeah, no. I've never been to Perryville. I have never been to women's prison. I have been to a men's prison several times. I can't imagine. It's a whole hell of a lot different. And I have read, you know, a ton of documents and testimony about prisoners. The Marshall Project, which is, a social justice project about incarceration, has a lot of great information, like firsthand testimonials about prison. I listened to every episode of Ear Hustle one summer when I was planning to read the book, which is a podcast about San Quentin. There's a really good podcast it's a Canadian podcast. I got to remember the name. It's about female prisoners and their stories. And I've read a lot, but I also have a couple of female friends who were incarcerated, who I talked to. So it's not that unfamiliar to me. And, you know, there's a lot of documentaries about this particular prison you can see online. I mean, not online, on TV. So yeah. There's enough information out there that I felt comfortable writing about it. And I have enough experience that it wasn't, you know, something that felt totally unfamiliar.
Talk about creating the characters. You mentioned a Greek chorus. You have a character who contains a Greek chorus within her. And so talk about creating these characters. And the decision you make in this book, it's extremely violent. Talk about deciding to write that book about these characters.
Is it really that violent compared to other books? Is a question I like to ask myself a lot, because I don't actually think it's that violent. I mean, I know it's violent, but like if you look at, you know, other works, there's more violence and more death. And, you know, I'm judging a book prize, literary prize for mystery and thriller this year. And I'm reading a lot of violence, but it's just not shown and it's like not demonstrated. I think that we have a palette, an unlimited palette for off the page violence or violence that's tempered, or we can read a book about serial killers and they kill a lot of people, a lot more than anyone gets killed in my book, and a lot more violently, I would say. Serial killer ritualized violence is something that we just love in fiction, and not me personally. But if you hold up a mirror to like smaller acts of violence, people get really freaked out and say, "Wow, it's really violent." And I
That's
think
what I would
like
suggest is that
no.
there's not so much as much killing or fighting in this book, but there is the characters in it, in particular Dios, maintaining a constantly violent state of mind, and I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, I think that's what terrifies people. And that was the exercise. I was like, I want to write a book in which women are allowed to be violent in the same way men are in Westerns or in, like, for instance, Star Wars. Like there's a lot of death in Star Wars. And we're totally fine with it. Like people are killing their fathers or their mentors or just like getting their heads chopped off. And everyone's like, oh, okay, that's cool. If a woman does it, people really freak out. I mean, there's an opening scene in which a woman sticks a fork in another woman's face. And I gotta tell you, I get a lot of messages about that. And, it's pretty gruesome, but at the end of the day, like I've had really bad accidents that were way more disgusting than that. I mean, not in my face, but I've fallen down the stairs and had my leg impaled by something, a saw down to the bone. I'm not like screaming and crying about it. But
Boy, I
that
would be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm screaming crying what it happened, but I'm like, not like it's so gross. Yeah, it was actually pretty gross. But I think the fact that I showed it and I think that women do it, like, I think that we just don't really ever see the violence in mysteries or thrillers. We just see like someone gets shot, or like if it's like ritualized violence, we see like the ritual, but not the violence. We see like all the like True Detective, like bells and whistles, like the not the recent True Detective, but like the we see the crosses and the antlers and the ropes and the candles and the ligatures and but we don't see the loss of life. We don't see the struggle. And I think that just by showing a woman get a fork in her face, people like are pulled up short. And I really wanted to see what my readers would think about that. And it was a big swing because I kind of knew that it would be like an issue, and it was, and I was right that people didn't like it, and I think I'm right to show it to them because if you don't like that, you probably shouldn't read, like, I don't know, one of these serial killer novels I'm reading. And it was also I wanted to write about violent characters, and that was really hard to do without justifying it and saying they had a bad upbringing or it was nurture, not nature. And I wanted to write about people who are violent by nature.
I think one of the things that is so powerful about this book is that the characters come from a variety of economic places. And I think that that makes the portrait of the world that the characters live in, the world all of us live in, really much more well-rounded than your usual romp with murder. We are very used to people in mansions and lovely houses being murdered in unpleasantly creative manners. But to see the kind of everyday feel for violence that you portray, particularly in the prison where people are screaming at one another, threatening one another. It's a frightening place, I think that, and I think you do a beautiful job of orchestrating that, which is to take the reader in like waves and swings up through like a little gulp of air and then down into the depths again. Do you, when you write this, especially when you wrote the opening of this book, how did you orchestrate it purposely, or did you just let it rip?
I wrote that prison riot scene a little bit late. Is that the scene you're referring to? Like the one where, oh, yeah. I wrote that a little bit later. I'd written that was like maybe the last part I put into the book, or it was a later addition. But I needed to show a little bit of a like I never wanted to justify the violence in the book, but I wanted to justify Dios's obsession with Florida. And I needed like an origin story for that, like a moment that she sees straight through to Florida's actual nature. Those are the two characters. One is a rich white girl, and the other is a half Latina girl from a woman, I should say, from New York City. The other one's from LA, the rich girl's from LA. Woman. And that prison riot scene sort of came later as a way to coalesce a lot of the ideas of the characters and to really sort of showcase the environment that they were living in and the frustrations of being a woman in prison, being at the mercy of the guards, being demeaned by other women. I think that's another theme in this book, is the thing women do to each other, which I think is sort of done in fiction in a very conventional way. Like women are catty or bitchy or like they're underhanded, but like there's some dark shit that women do to each other. And so like I wanted to talk about that. But that scene sort of became, it was sort of my favorite part of the book to write. And sometimes the best part comes last. Like the best part always comes first and last to me. Like I have some major piece of opening salvo that I want to get out and just write it. And that becomes the tone of the book. And when I this book opens with when I first wrote it, the closing scene was the opening. Then I needed another piece that sort of hit the same notes as the end. And I did open with the prison riot at one point, but I pushed it later on. It was really kind of fun to write. Like it was fun to write about the darkness and the prison being the lights being out and what that felt like and what it's like to be in a big industrial building. I don't know. I mean, I happen to have had this experience, which is kind of weird. When there's a power outage, it's really scary to be in a huge like warehouse, or I was in a big old building in Boston and the power went out and you just feel really scared and lost and lots of bad things happen. And I really felt like that was a really fun place to play around with like all the possibilities for danger.
One of the things that I think makes this book feel more violent than it actually is the are the emotions and the depths of the emotions and the way they come out. Talk about creating violence not just as inflicting hurt, physical pain, but emotional pain, and the way that you handle that is it's similar. The emotional pain that is inflicted with the same kind of a lawn and intent that the physical pain is intended.
Well, I feel like violence is something that we sort of misunderstand as only physical. I mean, of course, we know about emotional abuse and whatever, but that's like a little bit different than what I'm talking about. I think that like in certain ways, like being a woman in society is being like living in a you live in like a cesspool of violent behavior all the time, even in the most sort of mundane circumstances. There's so many transactional things that women have to endure every day. Like you have to be nice to this person who's helping you build something in your, new house, and like, and it feels a little, it can feel a little scary or a little overwhelming. That's a really strange example I just used. But there, and I wanted to sort of address how we misunderstand violence. I mean, this is a bigger theme in my previous book, These Women, which is about a serial killer and sort of about all the women who live around him and how he's not really in the book, but how his actions, not just to the people he kills, but to the people he's living with or cohabitating with or, raising, how that is violent in and of itself because they're being lied to and there's this sort of miasma of violence around him. There is this emotional violence. There's this idea that, Dios is unrelenting and she believes that Florida is inherently violent and will not admit her nature. And her approach to dragging that out of Florida is this sort of onslaught of emotional attack. Like she's trying to strip her down, she's trying to belittle her, she's trying to summon, she's doing everything she can to make her friend admit what her true nature is. And Florida is also very, in my mind, she's a violent person. She does a lot of, like, even though she's lying about it, she to herself, she says, you know, I'm just, you know, a rich girl who got in the way of some bad people. But the truth is, she did these things and she did them on her own, and she no one told her to do them, and she's trying to run away from that. And you know, in that act itself, it creates this sort of violent tidal wave behind her, because the more she runs away from it, the more it starts to overtake her.
One of the distinctions I think you make that's very important and really interesting is the idea of owning up to the things you have done. Dio was right up front about owning up to what she's done, and she's quite disdainful of Florida, who or Florence, depending on which persona she's wearing, who at every attempt tries to avoid being associated with or responsible for the violence that she's done, when in fact she has done and enjoyed it.
You know, and it's not her fault, Florida Florence, is that she's that way. I mean, that's the way society is for women. Like, we are always excusing. I mean, yes, for the most part, men are more violent than women. And yes, I will acknowledge that, like, the majority of female crime is retribution or fighting back against an abuser, or, you know, parental, sexual, spousal abuse, or violence against your own children because you have some kind of postpartum depression. But there are women who are violent, of course. There are women who join gangs. There are women who run drugs. There are women who, especially, the drug cartels, who are really high up, who order executions and stuff. That's not nature. I mean, that's not nurture. That's nature. You know, and I think in fiction and definitely in real life, we are always looking to excuse women's violence by saying, you know, oh, you know, she just fell into the wrong crowd, or she was on drugs, or, you know, her boyfriend made her do it. And we don't actually give women the opportunity, oh, it's not the opportunity, that, like, we don't give them the sort of permission to actually acknowledge that they did these things. And I think it's really, that's what I was trying to talk about with Florida, is like, she set this camper van on, she bombed this camper van, and we, like, kind of enjoyed watching these people die. And yes, she was on drugs, but yeah, she really wanted to do this. And we sort of excuse it. Like, if we look at, like a lot of the 60s crimes, like women who were in, you know, Helter Skelter or the Symbionese Liberation Army, we excuse them because they're brainwashed. But, like, there has to be a part of that where, you know, that was what they wanted to do. And I think it sort of denies women the strength of their own opinions and actions, like that every woman who commits a crime has to be brainwashed. It's just, like, preposterous to me, and really dismissive, you know? So yeah, like, Dios is mad at Florida for not admitting this, but she understands that it's not Florida's fault that she doesn't admit it. It's like they built this gilded cage of denial for her. Her mother, you know, the justice system, and Theos has just had enough. She just thinks it's bullshit.
You know, what I think this book also is just an incredibly powerful and beautiful portrait of the homeless. I mean, it's kind of gobsmacking the way you describe it.
The homelessness.
Yes, the homeless and homelessness. Talk about the power that homelessness plays in your novel, and also just in the makeup of the Los Angeles.
So, you know, I work in Skid Row, and I have for 12 years now. So I'm very familiar with the landscape of the unhoused and homeless crisis in Los Angeles. And it's a little bit different, multifaceted than people think. Well, it's a whole hell of a lot different. And this, I'd written a book previous called Wonder Valley, which takes place in Skid Row, and it's set in 2018, I think, maybe a little bit earlier. came out in 2018. And homelessness and the unhoused population changed dramatically during the pandemic. And this book is set during, Singer Down is set during the pandemic. And I sort of wanted to look at the evolution of the landscape in Los Angeles. And the pandemic was long. It was really long in Los Angeles because we were under, or in California, I guess, we were under two or three different lockdowns. And during that time, the encampments around the city just spread like wildfire. Every inch of the 10 freeway by my house of the embankments was an encampment. Every overpass, if I went from my house like 4 miles to downtown, every overpass had a full-on, like there was just tents and sleeping bags lining both sides of the on both sides of the street, I should say. And it's a, and I, you know, I was kind of at home a ton. I had a young kid and wasn't able to do much for 2 years. So I would take an hour and a half walk every day and I would just sort of explore the neighborhood. And there were these tent cities that were popping up and they were becoming more and more permanent. Like the structures were no longer like what you would think of, like there's a tent and there's a tarp. There were plywood structures and they were made out of lots of found objects, big billboards and whatever. These sort of tents that pop up at flea markets or at tailgates advertising like Rockstar energy drinks or whatever. And there was plumbing, some not plumbing, there was electricity run into them and gas cook stoves. And I just sort of started to see this like other city layered on top of Los Angeles that just completely hadn't been there before. And it was a sort of different view on the unhoused population that I had working in Skid Row, where there's definitely more of a communal pull towards the gravitational pull toward the community of Skid Row. These were very ad hoc communities, and they seemed to be more sort of, isolated and self-sufficient, and it felt like this other city had suddenly popped up. It's completely gone now. That is over. I'm not an expert, so I don't know exactly what happened. I mean, I know that the city got rid of the encampments, but I don't know where that population has gone to. I think some of it's pushed outside of the actual city, but it was a pronounced difference in the landscape of LA that was for 2 years, and you don't see it anymore. Like they clear cut the freeway embankments, so you can't camp there anymore. I walked all up and down the freeway encampments and through the embankments, and there was just all these things in my book are real. Like I didn't make it up. Like all that, like these little houses that you would find by the side of the road, by the side of the highway, or in the accident investigation site, like that's all stuff that was really there, just not there anymore. The city really cracked down on it. But I sort of, I think the book really captured this moment in LA. And it's an interesting question because it's set during COVID, right? And so, like, what does safer at home mean when you don't have a home? So, bringing it up.
It reminded me of a scene from a late 1980s movie by John Carpenter, They Live. And there's a scene where you can see where he's, I think, must have just cleared out a whole parking lot in downtown LA and populated it with obviously one-time middle-class people who are sitting there like with the remains of their furniture and their TVs kind of plugged in. It's like that you moved as much of your house state from the suburbs as you could fit into the car and put it out in the middle of a parking lot. And that's what it kind of brought to mind was that. And when you were just describing it, you were saying it was like another city layered on top of the old city. And that brought to mind, William Gibson saying, the future doesn't arrive in all at one place, part. It arrives some places, early, and the future is irregularly distributed. And that made me think of that, my God, is that the future of America?
Hope not. But I feel like it might be, to be honest.
We're working our way towards that.
Imminently.
I have to say that there's a kind of a Rashomon effect in this novel, the way you write it, where we'll see parts of a scene from one character's point of view and then back to another. I think it's just so beautifully plotted and written. Did you have to work that out on a timeline?
No, not really. I'm pretty good at holding that stuff together in my head. You know, I just sort of saw the whole outline of the book. I just wanted it to be in these two parts with a little squishy part in the middle. Like, I wanted the prison part and then the LA part. And then when we meet the detective, it sort of comes together. And I just feel like for me, I like to tell a story from several different perspectives because I feel like you get a richer sense of a particular event, like what it's like from the detective's perspective to what it's like from the murderer or like one of these escaped convicts. Well, they're not escaped. Well, they sort of are. They have skipped parole in like the same scene seen from that perspective. It just looks different. And I think that it creates a sort of panoramic view that the audience or the reader can really sort of get a richer, more three-dimensional take on what's happening. Because there's like what's a certain thing looks like to one person, it doesn't look like to the other person, and it's not correct either way. You need both, in my opinion.
I love Lobos, the cop, whose first name we glancingly see kind of when her ex-husband says something to her, addresses her not as Lobos, but something else, and her partner, Easton. I think you do a good job of taking Easton, who at first seems like a complete jerk, and slowly, like, you know, chiseling away parts of the jerkiness so that he's still kind of a jerk, but less so. And that's a beautifully subtle piece of characterization. Talk about creating the characters who aren't dominant in the narrative. And I'm thinking, too, of the mother, who is a piece of work, shall we say.
Yeah. So Easton he's Lobos' partner. He's a guy. He's a traditional male cop. And he's right that women don't do these things. And he's going to say it. And his partner, Lobos, who is sort of has a chip on her shoulder about being a woman in the force, who's been sort of mistreated, just short of abused, a lot of workplace discrimination about her, you know, stature. She's short about being a woman. She's hiding the fact that her husband is emotionally and somewhat physically abusive, her ex-husband, that she can't control him. She's really anxious about that because she can't keep order at home. How can she keep order on the streets? You know, it makes a lot of sense to me that she would be worried about that. And she's investigating this crime, this really violent thing that happens on a bus. And Easton, her male partner, just says, women don't do this, and she can't handle it because she wants to pop off at him for being, you know, a man and being, you know, dismissive of women's power. But the fact of the matter is, like, the man is correct. Like, women tend not to do these things. Doesn't mean they don't. And I think you need that. But I didn't want Lobos to be like 100% right and like lead the charge and say, this is, you know, she needs to be kept in check. And, you know, she is very quick to take offense at things. And I think that's why they work really well together as partners. They secretly get along. They really like each other because they complement each other really well. But you can't have one without the other. You can't have the everyman cop without someone who's, I hate this expression, but it's just thinking outside the box. And you can't have this renegade woman who really sees that, like, women could do this without someone being like, well, I mean, they could, but most likely they didn't, you know. And he is actually right about something. He's like, women kill people they know, you know, and that's what these women have done. They've killed someone they know, or one of them has. And so someone who's, you know, hurt her in the past, which is sort of interesting because Easton's right about it. And Lobos is just like, shut up. Like, you can't just read me statistics about like how, but I think that they work really well together. And I think that, you know, he's a minor, very minor character. But he gives Lobos something to bounce off of with her theories, and he grounds her. Otherwise, she'd be spinning into butter, just like, you know, spinning out into, you know, something crazy. And it needs to be, you know, her investigation has to be balanced by what the real world expectation, what the crime should be. And he does that. It's fun to like sometimes like just being able to touch off a character with very small details or not a lot of screen time or page time. Not screen time. I've never written a screenplay in my life. So page time is really a challenge and it's really rewarding.
I would suggest that, in a sense, you have written a screenplay because as one reads this book, it's just in it's very visual. It's you experience it in very much like a movie, but it's a movie where the visuals are intense, but also the emotions, the things that are internal that a movie could never easily convey are also in them. So it runs at two different, very high levels. And talk about pairing those kind of emotional things with the blazing sunset and the awful heat and the terrible scenes of, downtown and just the scungy motel in the desert where they stay. Oh my God, it's just, alas and alackaday, I've been to all of those places.
Me too. Me too. I don't know. I just like to write about places like that. I don't know. I don't, it's just what appeals to me. I just wrote a book, a new book that's very different to anything I've ever written, and it's set in a luxury hotel in Greece. And I'm just like, okay, enough of that. Like it wasn't for me. I mean, it's good to be a good book. And it's good to be it's great, but it was just funny to write about it. And then I was thinking what I want to write next. And I'm like, oh my God, I need to get back to like Los Angeles and I need to get back to these gritty places. I'm a little tired of the word gritty because it's always like the catch-all phrase for everything I write. It just happened to be where this book takes place, in those locales. But Florida is rich. She does live in Hancock Park, or her mom does. They have a mansion, they have a Tudor mansion, which I find repulsive. I absolutely hate mock Tudor architecture. Like, I just hate it. It's my least favorite form of architecture in Los Angeles. Just like, why are we pretending that you live in a storybook cottage in like, Lake District in England? It's so weird to me. And I find it so jarring and strange. I like lots of other of the architectural styles. So like for me, that's the weird place to write about. Like, why do you have a fake rose garden here? I mean, we're living in a drought. So I don't know, like sometimes I think really important, difficult, heightened emotions sometimes for me require like more sort of stripped down places, like gritty motels, dirty motels.
This book is a very visceral page turner. It's very hard to put down, and I'd like to talk about creating that fast pace without, so many books that have a fast pace. Essentially, sometimes I just want to say, well, I'm tired about reading this chase. I just want to get to, figure out who done it. That's not the case here. You want to be in every page till the end, and it's, like a fire. You want it moves fast. So talk about creating that.
One thing I really wanted to do is write the action without a lot of backstory and explanation and like a lot of or justification. Like I think a lot of times in fast-paced books, these are the like too much action. It's like, there's this giant scene where they're freeing all the people from the underground prison and like the cop or the dungeon and the cops are coming and someone gets shot. So it's like enough. Like I don't need to see these giant action sequences. But this book has something keeps happening. It's a cat, it's a chase, it's a chase across Arizona to Los Angeles and then across Los Angeles. And like one person's pursuing the other, and when someone's pursuing another person, they don't really stop. Like they do I had to like have them sleep, and it was kind of interesting to figure out like how they could rest and wh what would that would be like, because it's not really easy, when you're like unhoused and there's a pandemic. And but the I kept it going by not sort of reflecting back onto like what they're thinking about in their childhoods when they're doing stuff, and not having a lot of there's a little teeny tiny bit of backstory for both of them about how they got into prison. And Dios tells Florida one thing about her childhood. But in general, I didn't want to like spend time like internally justifying what they did or looking back in the past. So like that made the pages keep flowing for me. And it was hard because I kept saying, you know, I'd write something and then I'd be like going to Florida's childhood. I'm like, nope, that's not part of the story. Like she's not part of it at all. Like we can't have that in here. It's only in there when it explains, you know, why Dios is mad at her, like what Florida did in her past that. But in general, in the action scenes, there's no, I don't stop it. Like I think of books, like I think of what I write and teach. Like the story, the present story is blue, it's like water, it's flowing, it's a highway, you're moving, 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 moving. And then like backstory is red and it stops it in the tracks like a stop sign. And like I want a little red in this book as possible. I just want it to keep going.
You write some beautiful prose and many things that, you know, you want as a reader, you just will remember. Like some people like to watch the world burn and others like to set it on a fire, which is a wonderful sentiment and so true. And this is, you know, these days you can't watch the TV for more than 10 minutes before somebody says the world's on fire.
I know.
And so that particular sentiment really rang true in a universal way as well as in the low-key way. And I think that one of the things this book does is it plays out in a very realistic, low-key manner. I mean, none of these people are going to rule the world or do something of great note. But all of them feel like they are of great import to the reader as we read them.
You know, I think part of that is sort of creating a character with a full worldview. Because, like, if you have your own worldview, you are your own world, and it seems like you can sort of influence other people with your, or not influence. You can summon your worldview, and you feel wholly realized, and like you have a way of engaging with everything that's three-dimensional and sound. And I think that that's sort of like it's important to understand who your characters are, because then they become like fully important to the story as opposed to just like pawns or like plot devices. And like Dios and Florida, they have, oh, and Lobos actually as well, all three women have pretty well-developed worldviews. And in every situation, I know how they will react. And it makes it sort of profound to me. And that's why the book is sort of short, because I don't want to like, I didn't want to overextend that. Because it is difficult, you know, it is violent at times. But you know, I wanted their importance to be manageable and reasonable, but not to overstay its welcome.
You have a wonderful sense of the supernatural in this book. It's there, but it's used more in the externalizing the internal perspective. Also, I think the character who's the Greek chorus is Iris.
Case.
Case, yes. Case is a wonderful character. And, you know, I've known people who have heard voices within them. And to explain, use the supernatural to explain those voices seems absolutely logical. I mean, what else could it be? So, talk about, and also your visions of the murals. It's just really, really wonderful. So talk about using a cone of the supernatural to, I guess, a bold, put in bold some of the things that might otherwise be escaped.
Well, yeah. So, you know, I'm deeply influenced by my friend Jonathan Leighton's book, Fortress of Solitude. If I say this one more time, he's probably going to kill me. Or maybe not. But, you know, we grew up in the same neighborhood. I'm a bit younger. And when I read that book, I was really taken with this element, there's a speculative element in the book. There's this magic ring. The book is so grounded about the streets I grew up on, the kind of people I grew up with, but he's sort of put his own stamp on it. And it's the thing that people don't like about the book. They're wrong. If people don't like something about the book,
Yeah,
they
no,
are wrong.
I read that book and spoke to him about it. It was superb.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a perfect book. But you know, some people think that the fact that there's this ring, that invisibility, that they have kind of ruins the reality. And I think it's what makes the book possible. I think when you do something like that, you sort of can remove the criticism of people criticizing the world you created, because you're like, this is my world. You know, there are these things that can happen. That, you know, this is not entirely, it's realistic, it's emotionally realistic, it's physically realistic, but like, this is my book and this is my world. And like, you know, this is my take on this. And I think it's for me, it was, and I just love that you could transform something so hyper realistic to into something just a touch magical. But one of the things I am interested in, especially when it comes to hearing voices, and stuff of that nature, you know, tarot card reading, fortune telling, psychics, and this is in Visitation Street. It's like you can't disprove it. You know, if someone says they hear voices and they can tell you what those voices are, it is not for me to say you're schizophrenic or you're, you know, there's something wrong with you or you have a mental disorder. Like, it can't be disproven. What can't be, you know, what can't be proven can't be disproven. Like, maybe Case does really hear these people. I mean, I happen to believe that she does. I do not think that she is traditionally so-called a crazy person. She is, I think she really hears them, but in writing something like this, it, the case could be made that it is just a manifestation of her being in prison. It could be some kind of, you know, psychosis. And I love to play with that duality. Like, so, like, yeah, she certainly hears voices. Whether they're real or not, that's for the reader to decide. But I sort of like that possibility for two different interpretations. Now, when it comes to the murals, it's a little trickier because they do move, and that's not possible in the real world. So I'm just going to let it up to the reader to understand where this comes from. And if you read a lot of my books, you'll see it's in all of them. No, it's not in all of them. Yes, it's in the last four. The same thing happens in all four books.
For me, one of the things that I did after reading this book long ago in the before time when I drove around Los Angeles, I always had in my glove compartment a Thomas Brothers guide, which was a map that many lost people who lived in Los Angeles have, so you could find your way through any street. And after reading, getting only like halfway through this book, I had to look at the 10 freeway, which plays a huge part in this book, and I think obviously a huge part in your life. Talk about the power of the roads that connect us and, in a sense, run through us and run over us, and that do us a kind of violence constantly that is not often seen as violence yet. Nonetheless, I think really is.
Well, I'm particularly interested in the 10 freeway as it is very close to my house. And I've moved. I live even closer to the 10 now.
Where do you live,
I
Giuseppe?
live in South LA. I live in Baldwin Hills.
Okay, I know exactly
Baldwin
where that
Hills.
is. I lived in Covina.
Okay.
So,
Yeah. So I live in Baldwin, not no no not Baldwin Park. I live in Baldwin Hills. And
Baldwin Hills, right.
yeah. So I live by I live
By the Crenshaw District,
I live
by the oil wells.
exactly. Exactly where
Okay, I know, yeah, exactly where that
I
is.
live. By Kennepon Park, where the oil wells are. I live at the bottom of the park. The 10 freeway, especially in this part of town, was put here to break up a black neighborhood. They decided that this was the place to do it. They were going to destroy these homes. They redlined the district. So the 10 freeway is an act of violence in and of itself, much like the BQE in Brooklyn, the subject of Visitation Street. I just happen to live in places like this. I'm not like a huge red line expert, but you know, so I just think that the creation of this highway is an act of violence, is an act of like annexing the city. It's an act of driving people from their homes. And people who live near the freeway are being poisoned by it. Noise pollution, air pollution. I am interested in the freeway because during the pandemic, it was very empty and it was very strange to look at. And these encampments popped up, so it was a place of sanctuary for the first time ever, I think. The freeway is sort of this all, it's the great equalizer in LA. Everyone gets stuck in traffic. Everyone has to sit on the freeway, fancy cars, no, like people with drivers, people with driving cars with the doors are falling off and held on with duct tape. I find it fascinating to me. Like in New York, if you have money, you don't have to take the subway. You can take a taxi, you can take an Uber, whatever. You can take a helicopter if that's how you get around town. But in LA, you have to take the highway. We don't have public transportation in any functional way. It's getting better, but it's not great. The freeway is where people are working out a lot of their drama. This is like the subject of Wonder Valley. They're working out my novel. They're working out a lot of their personal space issues, their morning commute issues, their anger. The traffic is pretty bad. And I think it's just like a kind of interesting canvas for which to put action in books because it's sort of this place where everyone is at their worst, but we all rely on each other to be at our best so we don't die in traffic accidents. So I just find it fascinating. And I find like looking at the homes along the freeway fascinating. And you see really weird things on the freeway. You see, little fires or people having a drink or someone riding a bicycle. There's just endless information for me. And I'm from New York City. I take the subway all the time. And I came here and like I happen to love driving and I always have. So I just sort of paid a lot of attention to the freeway.
This is a powerful book too, about the pandemic, because it's not about the pandemic. The pandemic is the backdrop, but I think it's the best thing I've read or seen that is set during that time. I think it's so hard to deal with for all of us. Talk about your thoughts about setting during the pandemic.
No, it had to be set during the pandemic because obviously I was interested in compassionate release for COVID during COVID for prisons. And the book is set in the pandemic because that's when I wrote it. And I was stuck at home, and I think that sort of gave me the idea to write about a prison a little bit. I felt very imprisoned for various reasons. And I, there's all these editorials in the LA Times. We should never write about the pandemic. No one's going to want to do this. My ex-husband's a TV writer. I was writing the book. He's like, you can't write a book about the pandemic. No one will want to see anything set during the pandemic. And I'm like, well, now I know I have to do it because someone, like this is important. And if the thing that people are afraid of is the things they want to see, And so I just felt that like, it's not about COVID. It's not about, and there's so many like books that are like use COVID as a device to like lock strange people away together. Or it's like, my marriage did fall apart during COVID. But like, I there's a raft of like, less literary books about, people getting divorced during COVID and just like using the pandemic as a device or but I wanted just to have it as like that's just what's going on in the background and like what sort of issues are we going to have to deal with in a crime novel that's, in the pandemic? What I mean, LA was, I gotta, I talk about this endlessly. I've seen documentaries. I was watching the show Couple Marriage Counseling or Couples Therapy and as a reality show. And it's filmed in New York during COVID. And I'm like, oh my God, all those people are like outside at a park, like they're like picnicking. I was like, we didn't do that. Like we didn't leave the house. And I was like, yeah, it was so bad in New York. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe the first 3 weeks, but LA was a ghost town. It was for a year and a half. And then with the George Floyd protests, when like there was the National Guard and the city was on a lockdown within a lockdown and felt like it was military police and helicopters everywhere. I was like, this is unlike anything I've ever experienced. It feels apocalyptic. And I just really wanted to write about that because it felt really scary and it felt very, otherworldly, very, very eerie, and like something that I can't imagine would ever happen again in a pre-apocalyptic world.
I have a friend who lives just outside of Hancock Park, one on Orange Street, one street over from, I think it's, I don't know, one of them street, Vine maybe, I'm not sure. Lives near the Trader Joe's. And I've been to his house, and one of the things I did notice was all the helicopters and how bright the sky is and how much stuff is happening up above us. And I think that's one of the things this novel does really well, is it feels somewhat futuristic, even if we know it's set in the past. That I was reading this book, I'm thinking this reminds me of Blade Runner. With the movie, that is. And I was thinking how much the recent past reminds me of, you know, the dystopian future as we've seen it. Talk about, you know, creating that kind of feeling of, you know, the world is ended, but nobody knows because we're all too busy dealing with life as it is.
We're all too busy baking sourdough bread. You know, that's what it felt like to me. It felt like the world was ending in LA. I mean, like, it was just so strange. And there was the city sounded different. There was nature, wildlife. You know, it just, the colors felt different. The air was different because there were no cars driving around. It wasn't a lot of work to write it, to create that world, because that was the world that was there. You felt that you were going to die if you touched, I mean, that's everywhere. If you touch your groceries or what have you. LA often feels futuristic and like Blade Runner to me. In general, it doesn't feel like that far off, you know? So this was just an additional layer of, you know, the fear, the emptiness, the kind of weird beauty that came with that emptiness and fear. And then the George Floyd week added this other layer, that there was this idea that there were these people massing somewhere in the city and they were going to all die of COVID, or they were going to destroy the city. And I mean, that was preposterous, and really upsetting. And, you know, so it just felt like, and there was a curfew during that time.
And the unmarked vans.
Yeah, and tons of helicopters and like the National Guard rolling up and down the street, which is a really scary thing to see in a residential neighborhood. I saw it myself several times. You know, so it didn't take a lot of work. It was just like right outside my window.
The new novel by Ivy Pakoda is Sing Her Down. Thank you for joining me, Ivy.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.